This edition of This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you exclusively by Omnia Audio and the new Omnia 9. Didn't see that one coming, did you? Check it out on the web at omniaaudio.com/9.
And now, our feature presentation.
Tours. One of the 180-foot towers was taken down by the tornado, and it fell and clipped a guy line on the 380-foot tower.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
Can you handle the truth? Mark Persons is here to lay it out for you, along with Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome again to another episode of This Week in Radio Tech. The title says it all. We're talking geeky engineer stuff, from the microphone to the antenna at the top of the tower and everything in between. If it has to do with radio technology, which really encompasses a lot of things, you know, microphones and audio and RF technology and sometimes just how to get some interesting things done that broadcast engineers have to do to keep radio stations on the air, keep the lines of communication flowing, especially in emergency times. And we've got some engineers who are very good at doing exactly that. First of all, I'm Kirk Harnack. My full-time day job is I work for the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia, now collectively called the Telos Alliance. If you're able to come out to the NAB show, love to meet you, and come on by the Telos booth there. So that's my full-time gig. Also, I'm part owner of 4 radio stations in Mississippi and in American Samoa. So that's where a little bit of my current engineering experience comes from, to maybe host this show and try to bring out engineering ideas from our guests and our co-hosts. And let's go to, speaking of co-host number one on tonight's show, Chris Tobin, the best-dressed engineer in radio from Manhattan, New York. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. Hey, I'm having a good time here in Manhattan. We have sleet and snow and thunderstorms right now. It's a crazy, crazy time in spring. Right? Yeah, spring started, 2 days ago or 3 days ago. It's amazing. But here I work with the CBS radio stations here in town. And as broadcast technologist, I have the crazy job of playing with technologies and find ways to make money with it. So far, I've been successful. I'm still employed. It's good. I don't own any radio stations, and I'm not an owner or retail salesman for any kind of manufacturer.
All right. But you probably stay in plenty of trouble there at CBS.
Oh, boy. I can't even begin to tell you.
So you have ice and sleet in New York. We're about to introduce Chris Tarr, where he's got some of the nasty stuff. And here I am in Charleston, South Carolina, for the second show in a row. There's a golf course right behind the studio here. And today it seemed like it was close to 80 degrees outside today. It's absolutely gorgeous. So let's check in with our Northern Command, Chris Tarr, in Wisconsin. Hey, Chris.
Hi there. I am the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And as we were talking about earlier, dealing with a pretty major ice storm that came through, at least in the northern part of the state, down here in the southeast part of the state, just a light coating of ice. So I've got the tenant de-icers on, and so far things are good.
Cool. And also from up north, another guy who's maybe... he's dealing with snow and ice today. It's Mark Persons. We've had him on the show before. Hey, Mark.
Hi, it's great to be here. By the way, I visited that 2,000-foot tower, 5, 6 years ago, whatever it was. It was a great sight, but I can only imagine what it looks like today. And by the way, in Minnesota, we had a foot of snow last night, but it's very normal for Minnesota, so no big deal.
Minnesotans on ice, no problem.
It's just normal winter weather, although... we shouldn't have any more. It's springtime. St. Patrick's Day is come and gone, and it's time to bring on summer.
I missed introducing you, Mark, in this way. Of course, you've been a contract engineer for many years. You've run a great business. A lot of folks know about you and your wife, Paula. But you've been a columnist for Radio World, and you've written over 100 articles, 120 or 30 articles for Radio World?
Oh, actually, it wasn't that many for Radio World, but it was. I've given them quite a few. Common Point magazine from the 1970s. I wrote for quite a bit, and just on and on and on. It's a fun thing. Basically, I just tell it the way I see it. If I have an experience, I like to tell it in my own words, and that's just how it comes out.
We've got a number of subjects to talk with Mark about. Mark was on the show once before, and we just kind of hit and miss around the dial with the subject matter. We heard about some AM transmitter sites that Mark had been involved with, but we got a few specific things to chat about tonight on This Week in Radio Tech. But first, let's cover something topical: this tower collapse, and we're going to be chatting about what happens in a tower collapse. And I meant to send the link along to Burke. Hey, Chris Tarr, can you in our private chat, can you send that link? Let's see. Yeah, I guess you had the link to your own tower situation. Let me find the link that I had. I'll just send that on to Burke. There's a story about this, and there is a picture there. So let me stick that in here. Sorry for the inside baseball here, friends. And Burke, there's a link to a news story about this this television tower fall. So, Chris Tarr, tell me what you know about this television tower fall, 2,000-foot tower in Wisconsin.
Well, it's just outside of Eau Claire. I believe it's southeast of Eau Claire. 2,000-foot tower has a digital television and an FM radio station up there. And 2,000 feet, very high in the air. Even, the tower itself is situated on some high ground as well. The TV station and the radio station had fantastic coverage up there. Last night, we had a storm roll through. Actually, kind of an interesting late spring snow that came through, or early spring snow, rather, that came through the state, the northern half of the state. We still had some issues, even in Green Bay. Pretty much most of the northern part of the state got pretty heavily coated with ice. This particular tower got loaded up, and last night, I want to say it was somewhere around 9:30, 10:30, I got the word that the tower had collapsed under the weight of the ice. And after further investigation, we got some pictures this morning. At this moment, the TV station is broadcasting on a sub-channel of one of the affiliates there, Channel 18. I think they're on their DT3 channel. And the FM actually is running their programming on their sister station now on 92.9. So we really haven't heard a lot more out of there yet. I'm sure they're scrambling to kind of figure out what the next step is. And, obviously with a tower at that height, that's going to be a while to get that replaced.
Well, Chris, in the past, they had a backup facility in Eau Claire, right downtown Eau Claire, or near downtown Eau Claire. Are they no longer using that for video?
That's what I had heard. I heard the same thing, that they had a tower, actually, I believe, at the studio site, and a pretty substantial one. But what I'm gathering now is that that's not available to them. Hmm.
That is, in the chat room, they've been asking a question that a lot of folks would ask, which is, hey, what do you do when your tower falls down? And the first obvious answer is, well, if you have a backup site, whether you're an AM or an FM station, maybe even some AM stations have a backup site or a nighttime site or a daytime site. A lot of TV stations do have some kind of backup facility. Maybe they rent some tower space from a competitor, or maybe, like you said, they're actually transmitting on somebody else's a sub HD channel. Boy, when something catastrophic like this happens, sometimes you could just be completely off the air. There we see some video of the wrecked site. This 2,000-foot tower has come down. That's almost half a mile in height. Holy moly! That's a lot of steel to come down. What do you do, Mark Persons? Let's ask you for a second. You've been involved at least in a couple of TV stations, haven't you?
Actually, I've been a radio guy. Back in my career, I looked at doing TV, and because I came from a broadcasting family that did radio, that's where I went. That was the idea. And I actually came from a family of radio ownership, a couple of stations along the way. But after I looked at it, I knew I was an engineer. I wasn't a salesman. I wasn't a manager. I know how to put wires together. And gosh, sometimes I even know how to make them spark when I put them together.
So, sounds like your whole family are all television deniers. Is that it?
Oh, that's it. Did you notice that television is kind of on its way out? I noticed when I turned one on the other day, the picture was getting kind of fuzzy.
Me too. Go ahead,
Kirk. Somebody asked in the chat room, and this is actually I thought was a great question. When these towers fall, how do they fall? And,
oh yes.
The answer is it depends. A self-supported tower, in other words, a tower that doesn't have guy wires, typically falls like a tree. kind of comes down like this.
Really? I've never thought about a self-supporting tower and how it might fall, but yeah, it's going to be completely different than a guide tower.
It generally you know, kind of collapses this way and then down, right. Whereas a guide tower tends to fold in on itself. Somebody did a great example of this at a zoning board meeting where somebody was concerned about a tower falling on their house. You take a stack of cans and you pull a can out and see what happens. And the whole stack of cans doesn't fall straight down like this. It kind of falls in on itself in an accordion fashion and or spirals down. And in this situation, that's what happened. And I'm going to see if I can dig up a video later. There was a video circulating of a tower that went down, that they took down on purpose down in Hawaii. And it was a great example of how those towers fall. They kind of fall. They don't fall straight down, but they tend to fall this way and fall down and then out a little bit. And so they kind of fall in on themselves.
I've seen videos of towers falling. Actually, I've felled a couple towers where the tower would, if you can imagine, the tower would come down almost straight. It would wiggle a little bit. And then when the top guy wires were good and loose, then the top would fold over and maybe even pass by some of the other part of the tower on its way down. But usually a taller tower will just start kind of crumpling. It'll make a circle, a zigzag, and just come straight down. And some of the sections of the tower just get shoved into the earth full length. And, you know, never to be recovered. It's just not worth it. So they leave that steel in the ground. So you're right. Zoning boards often, people in a neighborhood are concerned about a tower falling on them. You know, I don't want to live right under a tower, certainly. But was this a tower coming down? Or is this just a tower?
That's a picture of the original tower.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And there's a tower now. Lovely. Ugh, that's just terrible. Well, wow. And it will take months to get that rebuilt. You know, building a tower like that doesn't happen overnight or even in a week or two. It takes time to get that. First of all, to construct the thing. They don't just have them laying around ready to put up, I wouldn't think. Not a 2004. Oh, there's engineering to be done. They may have to re-engineer the guy points. And if there's any new specs it has to meet up with, then the new tower will have to be certified to those specifications. You know, the guy wires keep a tower from falling over and, Even if you bust a guy wire or two, even on a tall tower, you still have plenty of guy wires left. And these guy wires keep the tower from getting, too far away from its base when it all falls down. So you can have housing and such, relatively close to a tall tower with rarely any kind of danger of those houses getting hurt. Now, ice falling from a tower, that's a different story. Let's talk about that for a minute. Mark Persons, tell me about ice falling off of towers in your experience.
Oh, if you go to the Shoreview project in St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul, where most all of the FM stations are and the TV stations are, they actually have a carport where there's concrete overhead. So you drive in there as quick as you can, and then the ice that falls hopefully will hit the concrete. And when you're done working, drive away as quick as you can. Now, that is if you have to be there under those weather conditions. But that's their plan there. But, interestingly, you talked about a guy line on a tower failing like that. We had a tornado come through my hometown, Brainerd, Minnesota, back in 2001, June 13th. What a day, huh? There were three tower directional right near where the tornado came through. There were a couple of 180-foot towers, and then there was a 380-foot tower in the middle. Anyway, one of the 180-foot towers was taken down by the tornado, and it fell and clipped a guy line on the 380-foot tower. So there was the tower with most of its guy lines, but missing a guy line about a third of the way up. So then you call a tower climber and you ask him to climb the tower and say, connect a line back on, would you please? And you have to ask the right guy or he might say no. And that's how it came out. We reconnected a line and then it all came out okay.
I guess a tower climber, and I've been told this before, a tower climber's most dangerous situation is not putting up a new tower. It's climbing a damaged tower because you don't necessarily know what you're dealing with, right?
Oh, I fully agree. I mean, towers are dangerous enough as they are, but then you add that to the equation and what have you got? It's a tough one. By the way, our entire town was out of power for 25 hours after that tornado. The tornado actually clipped two sets of power lines that came from a substation at that end of town. And there was power lines going west from the substation and north from the substation. And darned if the tornado didn't come through at a diagonal angle and just clip both sets of lines and just took they had to put poles back up and everything. And it was quite a mess. And their town of 13,000, and it was 25 hours.
Let's call in our big city slicker, Chris Tobin. Chris, you know, in New York City, you don't have standalone 2,000-foot towers, but you do have some towers there. And I guess you do have some tall AM towers. And then you've got the towers on top of buildings where most of the FM and TVs are. How does ice affect you guys? I'm just so fascinated with ice on a skyscraper and then on a tower structure on top of that. What kind of things have gone wrong there, if anything?
Well, nothing's gone wrong. We do have ice. Let's see. In the city area, we have about a dozen tall sticks for AMs. They're about anywhere from 400 feet to 600 feet tall. They do accumulate ice. And most of our transmitter sites have ice shields at the base. And the buildings are designed to hopefully deflect most of the ice. On the building itself, the Empire State Building and Four Times Square, where there are broadcasts for both radio and television, there are ice shields at the base of the tower structures. On the Empire State Building, you have the mooring mast, which is that silver flange structure that you see on the building. And then above that is the actual transmission tower that sits atop for the broadcasters to use. And there are two sets of ice shields, you know, if you will, grating around the base of each one. And ice does come down off the buildings. There have been times when they've closed the streets on either side of the Empire State Building to avoid people getting hit. Several skyscrapers in town have ice coming sliding right down the side of them, huge sheets crashing to the ground. On the towers, our AM towers at Winds, 1010 Winds, we have four towers, and we accumulate ice, and it slides down the sides, and sometimes hits the ball gap for nice sparks.
Chris, you mentioned mooring mast. Now, does that harken back to the days of Zeppelins coming in and landing at the Empire State Building back in the 1930s, or that was their plan? Is that correct?
That is correct. The mooring mast is the structure that was going to be used to have people depart from the Zeppelins or the dirigibles. And I think rumor has it they did only one flight where they actually had people coming down off of a ladder or something to that effect. The updraft from the building was too difficult to maintain the dirigibles where they need to be. Then, of course, the Hindenburg didn't help matters. But yes, it is a mooring mast. It's referred to as the mooring mast. And if you ever had the opportunity to go up inside the structure, it's pretty wild. Lots of iron, and it's pretty cool to go out the hatch at the very top, you know, where the same hatch that people would have used to come into the building coming off the blimp, if you will.
I was going to say, can you imagine being a passenger on this Zeppelin, this airship, and you're supposed to get off the ship in that kind of an environment that high above the street?
It is. It's the wildest feeling. I've been out on the hatch on many a night, and it's difficult to describe, but I guess, you know, go to the Grand Canyon, go to some very tall mountain where you have only maybe, say, 30 feet of mountain around you, you know, in a circle around you, and everything else is just a straight drop to the ground. The Empire State Building, you come out of the hatch, and there's a small catwalk about 4 feet wide, and you have about 30 feet of building, and that's it. And the rest is the entire vista of New Jersey, Connecticut to the north, Westchester to the north, Long Island to the east, and then the ocean to the south. And it's just the wildest feeling.
And then, I'll tell you how you could get a similar feeling to that without breaking any laws or knowing anybody special. Go to Las Vegas to the Stratosphere Hotel, pay the fee to go up to the top of the tower and ride the Big Shot. Oh, there's that great picture of the dirigible connected to the top of the Empire State Building. But for, you know, a grand total of, I don't know, $25-$26 or so, you can get yourself a ride on the Big Shot at the Stratosphere Hotel. And it turns out, hey, okay, the folks at Telos, we tend to stay at the Stratosphere. It's a company tradition. And at least once during the NAB, man, I got to get up on the top of the the Stratosphere Tower and ride that big shot, and you just feel like there's nothing around you. If you can just imagine being in a dirigible and walking, you know, down to this thing, holy cow, that would just, I don't know how anybody anybody who wasn't accustomed to being at that kind of height could possibly do that. And no wonder it's, you know, it didn't catch on.
There was a good example. There was a TV program on, oh, I don't know, 6 months ago, and it was Tom Silliman from Electronic Research. And he was on top of the Empire State Building working on antennas on that mast. Did you folks see that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And there's some famous pictures from the New York Times and from a general. Oh, there's video on YouTube. We've shown some still pictures, and folks can go to the search for the video on YouTube about changing the light bulb. And there's a story by the photographer about how they had bad weather one night and had to go back again and to get up there on the top. But that is an amazing story. I'm glad you pointed that out, Mark.
Yeah. I also heard from a tower climber that the guy was using not as good a care as he should have, more like showing off up there. I don't know. That was the opinion of the tower climber that I talked to.
Well, you know, if I was on top of the Empire State Building, I might want to show off. Maybe not. Well, listen, we've covered this subject pretty well. Bad weather, ice, and snow can bring down towers, as we've seen. Someday we'll have it. We'll get Bob Silliman on the show because he can talk about structural strength of towers and what it takes to make things meet current specs and what brings towers down. Actually, that would be interesting to get that information as to how towers typically fail.
My joke about Tom is that if you can't find him, just look up. That's where you'll find him.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Wait, there's another great shot of the Empire State Building bristling with antennae all around there. Oh. Yeah, pretty cool. All right. Hey, we brought Mark Persons back. And Mark, you had a couple of subjects that you wanted to get covered here today. And, you know, one thing is a few people in the chat room and myself, too, had been interested in the microphone that you're using. Can you hold that mic up and let us see that?
Let's do that.
Okay. Now that looks like something, honestly, I don't know anything about a microphone that old or that design, but that looks like something that you might hear somebody speak into, something like train 42 to Poughkeepsie is now boarding at on platform 5. It doesn't look like a high quality mic to me. So you correct me. Tell me where I'm wrong there.
Well, at the time, it was state of the art. Gosh, this is a Gates G100 microphone. This harkens back to the 1960s when Gates Radio was selling everything from the microphone to the tower. You could buy everything, and they were priced right, and they sold a lot of those packages. And it was great for local broadcasters, the guys who had 1,000 watts day and maybe 250 watts at night. Or maybe they had 500 watts a day and that was it. That was their equipment because it was priced right at the time. And by the way, it's not really a Gates G100. I have a brochure here. It's an Electro Voice 630 on this catalog page right here. Uh-huh. And the price of it is $34.20. But I thought I'd use it because I'm afraid to mention this, but I installed it new in 1964 when I was helping my folks build one of the radio stations that we owned along the way. And I thought, gosh, what a great thing to bring in here. It's a dynamic mic and rugged as heck because it's an Electro Voice.
Oh, my goodness. You can beat nails with it, right?
Well, you know the Electro Voice story about the Buchanan hammer? It goes back to the Electro Voice 635A microphone. Who was it? Lou Burrows? Was he the salesman who would come around and he'd give the demonstration? He'd be talking into his handheld microphone, then he'd unplug it, then he would take a nail in one hand and put it on a 2x4, and he'd knock the nail into the 2x4 using the 635 microphone. And it was all beat up. Well, this is the 630 you're looking at, right? But and this would work probably equally well. And then he would take the same microphone and plug it back into the cord and start and resume his talk. And it would work. Now, what kind of if you're talking about taking a microphone out on remote with you, which one do you want to take out?
I can hear the commercial now. It's a microphone. It's a hammer. It's a microphone. It's a hammer. You're both right.
Oh, gosh. Well, anyway, I thought I'd show it off. I needed something better than the microphone that came with the video camera. And I thought, well, I got this in the back room. Why don't I use that? So that's how it came out. Oh, you lost my call sign, W0 Mike Hotel. That fell off the bottom. There we go.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Okay, great.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark. Go ahead.
Oh, we haven't had Chris Tobin say much tonight. I feel like I'm robbing the airwaves from him.
No, you're our guest this evening. That's not a problem. And the microphone, the EV635 Hammer is a nice one. Actually, we've got a few in our newsroom that people love to play with, and they sure look like we've used them to hammer some nails.
Okay. Well, I especially liked talking about this microphone tonight because Bob Heil was on, and he's a ham, and I have met him before. He's an interesting guy. And here we are talking about microphones again. And so I just thought I'd bring that up.
Now, I want to bring up another subject here real quick. We got a few things we're going to bounce around on, and a lot of these have interest to broadcast engineers, Mark. And one of them is the picture behind you on the wall. That's a picture of an airplane that made a famous voyage. It's the Voyager aircraft. But you had to pay a heavy price to get that picture? Or instead of what? Here, you tell the story.
Well, it's signed by the pilots, Dick Yeager and Gina Yeager and Dick Rutan. And it goes back to 1986, and I was actually asked to be a part of the project. Now, not me. I wouldn't be flying in the airplane, but in order to make a project like that go, where they were going to fly an aircraft around the world on a single tank of gas, they needed a lot of volunteers to do a lot of things. And my position there would have been to do avionics communications, do the wiring, that kind of thing. I have a history in avionics because when I was in the U.S. Army, I taught electronics and I did avionics when I was in Vietnam. That's a whole different story unto itself. But the point is that with that background, they thought I would be a good fit for trying to make all this happen. Well, in the end, I was busy building a two-tower directional when the flight took place. So I missed out on being a part of that project. And in retrospect, I should have instead gone and done the project instead of the two-tower directional. And that's why I wound up with the picture. And it's signed by those. And it's an expensive print of a painting. And it's who wrote that or who did it? I had his name here someplace. Anyway, a famous artist. And so it hangs on my wall, reminding me every day in the office that I should have done something.
That's a cool story. Well, how's the two-tower directional doing?
It got modified. And okay. It's on a different frequency now. It's a whole different story, but it wasn't worth it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, it's interesting the choices that we make in life, and sometimes we make the great choice, and sometimes we mess up, and we wish we could do it over again. So, Mark,
there's one other point, a point of interest from that. I just had a note here. When I got home, I got home during the flight, actually, from this building, this two-tower directional. And I turned on ham radio, and I think I was listening on 20 meters, and I heard them coming across Mexico from the east, heading toward California. And Gina was on the radio, and she could hardly put two words in a row. They had been in that aircraft for 7 days. Is that what it was? Cramped up in that thing, and almost no sleep. So it was really bad, and it was almost bad to listen to. But I did, and it certainly was an interesting experience for me. At least I got that part of it. Go ahead.
All right. Hey, actually, we're going to pause the show here for just a moment because on the audio version right here is we're going to put a message from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
So this episode of This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you exclusively by Omnia Audio. Have you heard of Processing Freak Day in the Netherlands? If you hadn't, you may want to check out their website. It's processingfreakday.com. So processingfreakday.com. And you'll find out about a really interesting event and some history behind this gathering of illegal pirate broadcasters and how they are really into high-end audio processing for their illegal pirate radio stations. And hey, all the manufacturers, all the processing manufacturers take part in this, or at least some of them do. And at this most recent processing freak day that just happened, Omnia, along with a famous guy named Leif Claesson, introduced the Omnia 9. That's right. Is it just another variation of an existing product with new badges and fancy marketing? Absolutely not. Omnia 9 is based on a completely new platform, unlike anything ever offered within the Omnia family. Now, if you go to the website, omniaaudio.com, there are some videos on the Omnia 9 webpage. It's Leif Claesson, who's the designer of this product, making a presentation about it. Quite a presentation. You want to check it out, go to omniaaudio.com/9. That's the numeral 9. omniaaudio.com/9. And, well, here's a few things about this Omnia 9. Leif will explain it to you a whole lot better than I can in just a couple of minutes. It has simultaneous separate processing cores for FM and for HD, and optionally for HD2 and HD3. This box, three-rack unit box, is the equivalent of half a rack of processors, especially if you're doing HD, if you're doing RDS, which is built in, if you're doing streaming and coding, that's built in too. Each processing core is separately fully adjustable and has selectable 4, 5, 6, or 7 bands. It has multi-band downward expansion, that's source noise reduction. It has a 3-stage wideband AGC with adjustable sidechain equalization. It has program-dependent multi-band compression, multi-band look-ahead limiting, adjustable dynamic bass clipping, selectable phase linear high-pass filter, 15, 30, or 45 hertz. For FM, it has a brand-new psychoacoustic distortion-suppressing composite clipper for unprecedented, pristine, distortion-free audio, even with difficult material such as a glockenspiel, even when that is driven into the clipper. And for digital, it has a 2-band final look-ahead limiter. Plus, there's selectable phase linear or low latency modes, fully automatic program-dependent declipper. Check this, a declipper and multi-band expander for damaged content, such as playing loud CDs on your program channel into the processor. It has streaming encoding built in. See, so it's got FM, HD, optionally HD2 and HD3, and streaming encoding that's built in for you as well. So it supports all different kinds of formats. For example, MP3, that's MPEG 1 layer 3, MP2, that's MPEG 1 layer 2, AAC, HEAAC, including RTSP/3G for streaming to mobile phones, plus Ogg Vorbis, WMA, and WMA Pro. There's live wire support. It's got a 7-inch front panel touchscreen, full remote control, an on-screen keyboard, as I said earlier, an RDS encoder. It's dynamically updatable. HTTP push support for automation like dynamic RDS and streaming song titles and preset recall. Day parting is supported. Dual independent power supplies. Just on and on and on. If you want to hear Leif tell you about it, and Leif is well known for audio processing, including the Breakaway box. In fact, the Omnia 9 is the software that Leif has been talking about for the Breakaway box. Go to the website, Omnia Audio. I'll spell it for you, OMNIAAUDIO, omniaaudio.com/9, and that's the number 9. Scroll down on the screen a little bit and on that page, and you'll see 4 parts of YouTube video that Leif Claesson, where he gave this demonstration and presentation at Processing Freak Day. Check it out. We got a whole line, no matter what your budget and what you can afford to do. They all sound great. The Omnia 1, the Omnia 5, the Omnia 6, the new Omnia 9, which will be debuting at the NAB show, and the Omnia 11, which has been shipping for several months now, that is taking big markets and a few smaller ones by storm. Check it out. OmniaAudio.com.
You are listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode number 75. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin. And our guest is someone we've had on before, and that's Mark Persons. Mark is a well-known contract engineer and consultant and author. He's written a lot of articles helping engineers how to, you know, he takes his experience and puts it into words, so you know, you can read about that. Hey, Mark, let me ask you about a couple of articles. What for you has been a really exciting, really memorable article that you've written, that, or maybe one that was just particularly helpful to other engineers? Tell me about your favorite article or two that you've written.
You know, I don't think I have a favorite, but on my website, I publish some interesting stories about things that I've done. And I think I was trying to point that out. It had to do with cows and RF. And basically, I was at a farm, and I don't know anything about farming. I have great respect for farmers, but I don't know anything about cows or animals or crops or anything like that. So I'm at this transmitter site, and what usually happens when I'm there is I'll be working there, and if the door is open in the summertime, all of a sudden there's a bunch of flies coming into the room, and I'm going, well, what's this? So I look outside, and there's cows there. Okay, mm-hmm. So that was okay. But one time I wound up in there, and there was a bull among the cows. And I was somewhat suspicious, but basically, and I have a picture of that. Can you put that up? I think we're passing up the first set of links on the old radio stuff. Oh, that's about the third one down.
Yeah, we're not so much
with
in order from
engineers and cows. Okay. Well, anyway, so I look out the door, and the place is surrounded by cows, but this one's got a bull. And I thought, oh, boy. And so I kind of go out there, and my plan was to shoo them away, just kind of make loud noises and tell them to go away, which was I was halfway successful at before. Well, this bull, instead of going away, came toward me and butted me, and it wasn't too serious, but I knew that the next time this could be real serious. I did get a few photographs, but I was in real hurry to get out of there as quick as I could. And it was, there's the vehicle surrounded by the cows. And somehow I was able to sneak into the vehicle from the side, you know, the passenger door and get out of there. When I got back, the vehicle was an absolute mess. The cows thought that it tasted good. So there they were. They were licking on it. I took it to a car wash. That did about a half of what needed to be done. And then I spent the next hour at home washing all this stuff off. It was pretty bad. This was after the car wash, which you're seeing right there. I'm surprised I didn't wind up with any big dents in the car. It was serious. But so I tell you. Oh, and there's another story about the manager of the radio station. This was the same day as the running of the bulls in Europe, someplace. You hear about that?
Spain. Yeah. Is it Pamplona, Spain?
Something like that. And so there she is, and she's got a twins banner, and she's like a bullfighter. And her whole idea was on my website to advertise the fact that her radio station plays the Minnesota Twins. So she, and her name is Chris Graham. Just a great lady. And I tell you, my best experiences with working with radio managers have been with women, interestingly enough.
So that's a great segue that you have provided to us right there. Let's talk about another woman, and that is your wife. Because, you know, most contract engineers, most of them that I meet, I can think of one other contract engineer whose wife is a part of the business. And you're married to Paula Persons, and I think she's extremely helpful to you. Wouldn't you say the same thing?
You gotta believe it. We wouldn't have the success that we have without Paula. And I have to tell you, so many engineers in my mind did it wrong. They do all their own billing, and the wives do nothing. I think it happened because our family, I came out of a family business of working in radio. So my mother worked in the front desk, my dad was the manager, I worked at the radio station, I was the engineer, and I did some air work and all that kind of stuff. But the point is, it was a family effort, probably to the point of child labor laws should have come into play here, but they didn't. That was years ago. But the point is, it makes so much sense, because I don't know, and I don't need to know everything about QuickBooks and taxes and all of that. Why not let Paula take care of that? And she does that and much more. We do a lot of bench work here. She does all the shipping. She talks to the customers. You name it. She's as busy as I am. And it really, really, really works well. And there's a picture of her somewhere on my notes here. Oh, there she is. Okay. Not so flattering picture of her. But anyway, I wouldn't, if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't do it different in the least. And by the way, our business is in our home, which is an unusual thing. A lot of people can't do that. But for me, it's just natural. One of the radio stations our family owned was the radio station was in the basement, and we lived on the next floor up. I mean, that was maybe that's where I learned all this stuff. Maybe that's how I found out that that's the way I want to do it. But it's great, and there's no commute other than 60 seconds. And then when I go out on a job, well, I just leave from here. And I've got all my tools and everything, and it makes me very productive. Probably bad in some ways, too. Ah, oh, there she is. Who's that handsome guy standing next to her? Oh, that's me. That's right.
So there's another subject on your list, Mark, that I'd like to get to. And this really kind of amazed me when you and I reconnected a couple of months ago about having you on the show the first time. And you mentioned that, hey, Kirk, I'm going to need to watch you guys talk. I don't always hear everything you say because I wear a hearing aid. And you have, I believe you want to tell us some pretty interesting information about how your hearing aids work, that they're actually extraordinarily sophisticated. And this is a subject that I think there's probably a lot of engineers. Maybe I'm speaking for myself. I'm kind of scared that what if someday my hearing falls off and I'm not able to be as helpful as I have in the past with maybe adjusting audio processing or telling if a signal, you know, what troubleshooting by listening to it. And so I'm afraid that would hamper those abilities in the future. You tell me, is this something that has hampered you, or are you able to deal with it? And tell us about the technology in your hearing aids.
Oh, well, I am reminded of when I was a kid, one of the neighbors had a hearing aid, and gosh, it had an actual tube, a vacuum tube in it. And it worked okay for him. I lost most of my hearing when I was in the Army. And so I've needed hearing aids for 40 years, and I finally got over the stigma of, gosh, somebody might see them on my head. So here's an example of one right here. It wraps around the ear, and then there's a plug that goes into the ear canal. And inside is, and you can even see through that, there's some sophisticated electronics in there that...
Oh my gosh! I think there's an Omnia One inside that thing.
It could be, but they come in all different levels of how well they work, and this mm-hmm. particular one is very good. And just like an Omnia, you can spend $8,000 for them too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This one is able to take frequencies up. I only hear to 3 kilohertz.
Okay.
It'll take frequencies up to 5 kilohertz and pull them down below 3 kilohertz. So it was a whole learning experience just to learn how to use them all over again or use hearing aids.
It does frequency, I guess, not just shifting, but frequency compression.
I suppose you could call it compression. Yeah. It moves those down so that I can hear those things.
Okay. Okay.
And then, of course, it changes the frequency response and does amplification and all those good things. So I guess if you can get over the stigma of actually having them and thinking that you're less of a man because of it, then maybe a hearing aid might be or tool might be the right thing for you.
So how are you able to troubleshoot effectively? Because I know you do. And so much, when I was doing engineering on a regular basis, so much of what I did had to do with listening. A station could call me from 50 miles away and they'd say, hey, we got a problem with this or that. It sounds bad. And I'm driving to the station and I'm listening to the station, assuming they weren't off the air. I'm listening. I'm thinking, oh, well, that sounds like the problem is going to be in the audio processor. Or, oh, well, it's not on everything. It's on something. So it must be a bad output from the sound card on their automation because they have 3 sound card outputs. You know, I could get a feeling of what was going on before I got there. And sometimes it was a little bit subtle. So kind of give us an idea of where you stand in being able to troubleshoot just by hearing something.
Well, all this time I've had to compensate for that by asking other people to help me. But then the other thing is I have a huge corral of test equipment. Everything from spectrum analyzers to audio analyzers and the whole business and oscilloscopes. I think I was born with an oscilloscope in one hand and a soldering iron in the other. So really, that has made it possible for me. As it turns out, I've turned out to be mostly a transmitter engineer, which is something that not too many people do. So I've kind of moved in that direction just because so much I'm needed there so much, like Star Trek, what did Spock say? Someone asked him why he was on the Star Trek Enterprise, and Spock says, well, Doctor, nowhere else am I needed more than here.
So, you mentioned the oscilloscope as a troubleshooting tool, and you know that's a good subject worth spending a couple of minutes on. I know that when I was a contract engineer, there were times when the oscilloscope was not only the right tool, but I got really good at using it because I got to learn what to expect from it. And you know, with an oscilloscope, you can analyze all manner of things, whether it's, you know, a stereo signal, a mono audio signal, some RF, intermediate RF signals. If you know what it is you're trying to accomplish with it, you can do all. I've even had the oscilloscope had to measure some high voltage, right, or a high voltage signal. So I've had the entire oscilloscope case at a high voltage so that it wasn't too much voltage for the positive input lead. So the whole thing might be brought up to 800 volts while I'm trying to measure a 2000 volt something or other. Tell us a bit about an oscilloscope's utility in troubleshooting, and what are some of the interesting ways that you've used the scope to get you right to the problem?
Well, first you have to think about an oscilloscope as a time domain instrument. In other words, the dot on the left travels across the screen and you measure amplitude from there. And there's a picture, great, and there's a sine wave. And it's amazing the number of people I talk to today who don't know what a sine wave is. So I have to sit down and draw one out. A sine wave is the kind of energy that you get from 120 volts coming out of the wall for your light bulbs and the way that the house runs. Have you ever looked at the sine wave that comes out of the wall just to see how badly distorted it is? Have you ever measured the harmonic distortion? 6% is a normal number. It's because it's all clipped off because the tops of the waveform are so heavily loaded, especially by computer power supplies that only like to draw current at the peaks. And then, of course, there are a lot of motors and light bulbs and all that kind of thing. So, and then I supplement that with a spectrum analyzer, which is a frequency domain picture in front of me. And how revealing that can be as well. Again, it's test equipment. You need the right test equipment in order to figure out what's going on. Well, that plus a lot of experience. And, of course, you gain experience by doing it and having the basic understanding. I'll tell you, I've seen a lot of broadcast engineers who really aren't engineers. They don't understand Ohm's law very well. And if you don't know that, if you don't know the true basics behind the whole thing, then those building blocks that you don't have aren't a good foundation to operate on. And so when you got that, then when you run into a new experience, you say, oh, that makes sense because I already know why all these basic functions are happening in the first place.
I remember as a teenager, I was getting into radio and I was being on the air and I was really interested in electronics. Hey, Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, you tell me if you've done anything stupid or crazy like this, or maybe you've done more. I somehow got hold of an old Army oscilloscope and it weighed a ton and it had a screen about that big, right? And I brought it over to the engineers at the public radio station that I was working at. And I said, hey, show me what this thing does. Show me how to analyze things with it. As I had a clock radio at the house, and I'd take the probe and I'd stick it on different leads of different parts. Ooh, what's the signal? Ooh, what's the signal? Oh, there's some audio right there. Ooh, there's some DC. And the engineer, this brilliant engineer, he set it up on a cart, and he took this oscilloscope and he took the not only the X input, but he took the Y input. And I think this oscilloscope actually had a Z input as well. Yeah, it did. It had X, Y, and Z inputs. And he hooked them up to some device that was in the equipment rack in the television side of the public facility there. And he made a few adjustments and then said, hey, Kirk, come over here and look at this. And there on my oscilloscope was a television picture upside down and backwards because he did the sync signals weren't exactly what the scope wanted. But there was a TV picture. Now imagine what would happen. You know what happened in my imaginative mind. Oh my gosh, this doesn't just measure a sine wave. You can make a TV picture on it. I had to work on that for a long time in my head to start understanding what were the possibilities of using an oscilloscope to troubleshoot things. Hey, Mr. Tobin, how about you? Did you play around with oscilloscopes and get to learn that way?
Oh, my goodness, yes. The oscilloscope I had was a 565 Tektronix. It was, about 3 foot square. It was vacuum tubes. The green phosphor CRT, picked it up for about $100 here in Manhattan at Canal Street, where you could pick up a lot of surplus stuff, and started to experiment with that for audio, voltage measurements, blew up a few tubes with it, but it was fun. Got a couple of shocks. You know, the few things you learn in the beginning is you need a multiplier on that probe, or if you try to do one-to-one and do high voltages, it's not a good idea. other than that, the scope. I use scopes today. I troubleshoot stuff. People look at me like, "How did you know that?" I said, "If you know how to use a scope, you can figure out the voltage." There you go. Classic red knob calibration knobs on the Tektronix. But yeah, you give me a scope, DVM, or a Simpson 260 analog meter, a couple of tools, and I can troubleshoot most anything, even digital stuff. But Mark's right. If you understand the principles, Ohm's law especially, you can do a lot, and that's the key, is understanding the fundamentals.
Chris, Tobin, it's kind of funny. You keep referring to Ohm's law. One of your colleagues, and I'll tell you the story at NAB, one of your colleagues seems to interview engineering applicants from time to time, and I've heard him comment, you know that fella? He was a little bit light in Ohm's law, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
Mr. Tarr, tell me about oscilloscopes at your place. I want our viewers to understand this is a fundamental tool that you will get a lot of use out of if you will teach yourself how to use it. Chris?
Oh, absolutely. I actually have several scopes. I have two or three. One that I carry with me with my tools in my car, and you know, each shop that I have has one. I think my first experience with one, I believe, was at Bell and Howell. It was my dad's. And I proceeded to smoke it once or twice, and he wasn't very happy about it. But that's kind of how I cut my teeth on it. I would measure everything I get my hands on with it. Anything that had voltage going through it, I'd take this scope when I was a kid and measure things through it. But it is absolutely, you know, even things like, you know, using it for, you know, check your modulation on your AM. You know, you could use that to do that very well. It's a very good basic piece of test equipment that everyone should have available to them.
You know, I think one of the greatest things about an oscilloscope is that electricity is in almost all times, in almost all forms, almost all circuits, electricity is invisible. And there's a wire there, or there's components there, and you know that there is some kind of signal there, maybe a DC voltage or an audio voltage. Maybe it's a varying DC. Maybe it's actually AC and crossing through the zero voltage point. Or maybe there's some RF signal there. Maybe it's a digital signal. So it's just on, off, on, off, on, off in a certain pattern, cadence, or representing ones and zeros. How are you going to know what this is unless you analyze it somehow? Now, there are digital data analyzers, and then they have to be set up for the right protocols for the whatever you're analyzing. There are, as Mark Persons pointed out, there's spectrum analyzers. But a spectrum analyzer, you can't always imagine what is on. Well, I guess if you're really smart, you can. But the oscilloscope lets you visually see what's going on a given wire given component leg.
Especially with digital transmitters now, or not digital, but the solid state transmitters, a lot of them with the pulse width modulation, PDM, PWM, in order to measure those and troubleshoot those, you need to have a scope to see what's going on.
And that is extraordinarily valuable. And so it sounds like we got four people on this podcast that are all saying, hey, the way I learned to use an oscilloscope was I started measuring things. And Chris Tarr, boy, that you just brought back, late teen memories here of taking a scope and just measuring everything I get my hands on, the back of the speaker, what's inside the clock radio, oh, the outlet, oh, be careful not to touch the 120 volts, and then start measuring RF stuff, like poke around inside a radio. And then not long after that, start poking around inside a transmitter to see see what was going on. And boy, you take the things that you learn from visualizing the signal at a given point in a device, and then you look at the manual, and then, oh, here's the schematic. Oh, and then, hey, I think I've mentioned before on the show that I don't have formal education in electronics. I don't think I could design something from the ground up, but I sure can troubleshoot it because I know what the components and the systems are supposed to be doing. Hey, Mark, let's contrast now with the usefulness of a spectrum analyzer, because you mentioned that right along with the oscilloscope.
Absolutely. And by the way, another use for oscilloscope that we used to use all the time was to time align. Left and right channels on cart machines or reel-to-reel machines, so we don't see those anymore. But we're still doing this. We're talking stereo, left versus right. If we got it right, is there a difference between the two when you think they're mono, all those kinds of things. But spectrum analyzer, that opens up a completely new window to see what's going on. You have a signal on the AM band, and then it's on 1,000 on the dial. And gosh, there's another radio station at 1050 on the dial, and it's not too far away. And so, and that 1050 signal invades the one on 1,000, and then a new signal appears on the dial down at 950. And why is that? Because there's a mixing product in that 1,000 transmitter. It winds up down at 950. And the spectrum analyzer makes it all perfectly clear. You can see it. You can see how far down in decibels it is from the station that's doing the intermod, the whole business. I tell you, without a spectrum analyzer, I'd be lost. Well, let's put it this way. I guess I was lost until I started having one 25 years ago, and I was even late in picking it up then because I needed it bad before that. But they're expensive instruments, but well worth it.
Now, Mark, you mentioned that you mostly do transmitter work. And yeah, I have a spectrum analyzer. When I was doing full-time contract engineering, I had a Tektronix 2710, and that served me really well. I did a lot of NRSC measurements with it and troubleshot a number. In fact, I troubleshot a problem where an FM transmitter was putting out signal at frequencies other than where it was supposed to. And lo and behold, those frequencies were the FM transmitter's carrier frequency plus and minus the frequency of the co-located AM transmitter. And it was causing some interference. So it was with a spectrum analyzer, it wasn't hit or miss to figure out where I needed to suppress the AM signal getting into the FM exciter. It wasn't hit or miss. It was pretty plain. Okay, I'm going to try putting a toroid on this lead. Nope, that didn't do anything. How about putting a better ground here? Nope, that didn't do anything. And then we ended up actually finding where the problem was, and I think we ended up using both toroids and better grounding. And then voila, the problem was fixed. An instant verification on the spectrum analyzer. Okay, I've just gone off in a different direction than I meant to. What I meant to ask you, Mark, was do you find use for both an RF spectrum analyzer and an audio spectrum analyzer?
Actually, I don't have an audio spectrum analyzer. I probably should. I don't know. How about the two Chris's? Do either of you have one, and do you use them, and how do you use them?
I have an audio spectrum analyzer. It's an old-fashioned gold line LED display one. It's okay. The problem is the different weighting scales you have to work with. I don't find too much of a need for it, whereas I do an RF spectrum analyzer, I find a lot of uses for. And just on the topic of oscilloscopes, those of us who might remember cart machines with the puck, you know, with the pinch roller, did you ever use an oscilloscope to align the pull-up time of each of the pinch rollers so they're equal? So when you had top 40 formats, the pop music, where you needed to get fast response for segues, remember doing that back in the day? Use an oscilloscope and look at the waveform. Just going back in the past on that one.
Oh, now what would you actually adjust? Would you adjust the air dampening in the piston?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And there was a whole circuit, a little RC circuit you'd use, and I wish I could find it. I had a little sketch of it, but I worked at a top 40 station where the PD was insistent that all the machines fired at the same way so that the jocks could do tight segues, and that was a trick. But that was the highlight of the day with the car machines.
So when they're aligned like that, you know, Cousin Brucey never has to say, well, don't put the song cart in cart number 3 because it's slow to come up.
Exactly.
Avoided that problem. Okay.
So along with aligning the audio channels left and right and the phase and keep it coherent, you also had the pinch rollers all synchronized together.
We'll ask Mr. Tarr the same question, but, you know, I was just thinking about probably half my oscilloscope use in troubleshooting was for aligning things that could mechanically get out of line that produced electric signals. And these would be tape heads. So on cart machines and reel-to-reel machines, I spent a good deal of time and made a fair amount of money aligning tape heads properly. Now that that's gone, for the most part, tape heads are gone. Is there really much to align in terms of stereo phasing anymore? Don't the things that we tend to use as broadcasters, that's just not an issue? It's not going to get out of alignment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think nowadays you're not dealing with anything with magnetic heads or anything like that. You're dealing with digital ones and zeros or audio sound cards or anything. I do, back to the spectrum analyzer, I do actually have an audio spectrum analyzer. I have software for Mac. It's called Mac the Scope, I believe is the name of it. And I do use that. I actually have a real interesting way to set it up is I have an old Griffin Radio Shark, which is a USB radio tuner. Well, the output has such a wide the frequency response is so wide on that you can actually see the pilot tone in the spectrum analyzer. That's how good it works or how well it works. And I use that a lot of times just to kind of for processing things, just, you know, if I want to see what some station's secret sauce is, I can kind of see how they have the equalization set on their audio and things like that. It's still handy to have, you know. I don't really, obviously most stations don't do audio proofs anymore, but, you know, every once in a while, you know, you want to see, is that STL working right? Is there maybe something going bad in the console, a cap going bad or something like that? And, you know, you think you're hearing something that's objectionable. It's a good way to kind of double check that.
Here's a good use for an audio spectrum analyzer, and even nowadays, is if you do need to go and align a stereo generator that's an analog stereo generator. And I know I worked, if Bill Sachs and his wife Kim Sachs were on our show a number of episodes back, and I'm quite sure that they use that to get the alignment of the 38 kilohertz and get the suppression of the, what is it, 76 kilohertz, whatever's a multiple of 38. Yeah, it would be 76, to make sure that is suppressed because it doesn't need to be a part of the composite spectrum outputs. That now, there are probably some RF spectrum analyzers. I think my Tektronix 2710 would go down to about 20 or 30 kilohertz, but I'm not sure how accurate it was way down there. So an audio spectrum analyzer can help you get things like that all aligned.
Here's a quick funny story for you. I come from small markets, and sometimes in the past, before we had NRSC low-pass filters, they would rebroadcast, say, an FM station for the Minnesota Twins or something like that. So they rebroadcast sometimes the pilot, the 19 kilohertz pilot, unknowingly, of course. Well, if there was a station 20 kilohertz down the band on AM, they would hear a 1 kilohertz beat note in their audio from this 19 kilohertz from 20 kilohertz away.
Wow. Okay. I'm just wrapping my brain around that one. Maybe you'll have to tell us about that next time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just about out of time, I guess.
Yeah. We sure are. We sure are just about out of time. This hour has flown by. Mark Persons, I appreciate you being with us. I hope you'll come back on the show again. We only got a little way through your list of topics to talk about, and there's others I'm sure we can spend a whole show on. And importantly, we can share your experiences with other engineers to give them things to focus on and maybe some ideas on how to do a better job of troubleshooting, or, you know, just get something accomplished that they weren't able to or were unsure of before. So, Mark, I appreciate very much you spend the time to share your knowledge with us.
Glad to be here, glad to be a part of this, and gosh, we've got plenty of more things to talk about next time I am here, and thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Hey, Mr. Tarr, thank you very much for sharing your experiences with us, too. Hey, what was the name of that software for Mac again? I thought I had it right, but I didn't.
Mac the Scope is what it's called.
Mac the Scope. All right.
Mac the Scope. Yep.
That would be your pick of the week.
That would be, absolutely.
All right, I'll check that out. And so thank you for being with us. Listen, good luck through all your bad weather up there. I hope nothing goes really wrong or bad.
Well, thank you. Hopefully, next couple of days here, the sun will come out and start melting some of that stuff.
Tomorrow it will. Thanks again. Hey, and Chris Tobin from New York City, thanks for being with us. Appreciate you sharing your experiences too. When are we going to get a tour, dude?
Shortly. Yeah, we had some issues. The last episode, I was moved to a different place. We had some transmitter stuff I had to take care of. Not a good thing. Hey, before I forget, for those of you who do know Art Constantine or knew of him, he passed away this week.
Yeah.
I know there's a few folks that listen to this netcast and definitely have worked with him and know who he is and may not have heard. If you go to Radio World Online, you'll get the details.
There's on all the listservs, there's been mention of that in the newspaper article. Art and his wife were killed in a motorcycle accident. And, I never got to work with Art, but I shook his hand at every NAB. And Art was the kind of guy who could memorize your name, call you by name, and was genuinely, he's a real fellow. And if you might remember, it seems like back in the 80s, maybe the late 80s, he was in a series of ads, I think for Fidelipack, that were notable for some reason. I mean, his friendly kind of goofy face was on the ads, and he was quite a spokesman for the different companies that he worked for. And I'll tell you, he's really going to be missed. He's a nice fellow. And in fact, I was thinking about him a couple weeks ago, just thinking about who the people I'd see at NAB. And he was one guy that I was, I need to stop by and see Art Constantine and shake his hand.
Yeah, no, he's definitely a genuine person and will be definitely missed. I just want to make sure I got that out to everybody because it's been running around here in the city, and a lot of folks here in New York City worked with him, knew him, and he visited everybody, and you're right. He met you once, and you knew your name forever. He'll be missed.
Well, and Art's passing does remind us that life is precious and cherish every moment. So you never know when it's going to be your time. Hey, guys, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it. We're out of time. And thanks so much for the chat room. We got a number of great ideas from the chat room. We can't use them all, but I try to read them all. If you'd like to add to our show notes for this show, you're welcome to do so as soon as I get it posted. I know I'm a little bit behind. You can do so at the website, which is thisweekinradiotech.com. thisweekinradiotech.com. There's a comment button underneath every single show posting, so you can comment. And if we miss something or if I don't post it correctly, please feel welcome to leave a correction and leave your kind comments. Appreciate that very much. You can subscribe to the show in the iTunes store. Just go to the iTunes store and search for TWIRT, TWIRT, or This Week in Radio Tech, and you'll get the show automatically downloaded to your computer or your iPhone device. Of course, you can like us on Facebook. We appreciate that very much, and you'll get some updates there. If you will like us on Facebook, you can listen to the show right there as well if you're in front of your computer. Thanks for joining us. We will see you next week with another exciting episode of This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
And this episode of This Week in Radio Tech has been brought to you by Omnia Audio and the new debuting Omnia 9. Check it out on the web at omniaaudio.com/9.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another twirt has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny Lopez Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.